Hello, you're listening to Radio Free Flint. This is Arthur Bush. Thanks for joining us. Our guest today is Jan Worth Nelson, a consulting editor and a writer for the East Village magazine.
I have been waiting to talk to you for some time. The pandemic sort of knocked us off kilter, but you're here now. And so I want to ask you, what is East Village magazine? And how did it start? And what did you do for East Village magazine?
Okay. East Village magazine started in July of 1976 by Gary Custer, who is a vintage Flint character. We still have an office on Second Street, a little office. And Gary's brother, Ed Custer, owns a number of houses in the East Village magazine and East Village area. So anyway, Gary ran the magazine pretty single-handedly for many, many, many years. And a lot of the people who worked for him never had met each other. He was a little bit of a loner, especially in his later years. It was devoted initially to neighborhood improvement issues, neighborhood preservation issues. I think that was Gary's passion. He was a journalism graduate from the University of Missouri. He was very well trained. He was a photojournalist by training. And so that's why the magazine has this sort of black and white aesthetic that he started. He loved that. So we're known for our black and white covers. Ed Custer has been doing these beautiful black and white covers for all these years. He still is. We come out monthly. It's a nonprofit operation, and most of the people who write for it are essentially 1099 volunteers. Gary ran it on a shoestring. I mean, basically, I don't think he ever got any money for it, but I did want to tell you a quick story. And just out of devotion, Gary was fascinated by his city. He had a strong sense of place. He lived in an apartment on Avon Street that he had from his brother, in a house that his brother owns. And towards the end of his life, as I said, he died in January of 2015, he kept a little bed in that office on Second Street. He had a sign up for a while on his door that said, hours open, like 11 p.m. to 5 a.m. Like, he never even wanted to see people. He did it all sort of remotely.
He started about the same time Michael Moore was getting on the run with his publications, right?
Right. Gary didn't see himself in competition with anybody else. He thought what he did was what he did. He wasn't an investigative journalist. He wasn't a gotcha journalist. He liked to cover just neighborhood things. And at the time, he looked at it as he was covering things that nobody else was covering. Like, he liked covering zoning board meetings because he thought things happened there that were as important as what was happening in city council, particularly regarding neighborhoods, you know? So that's always been our focus. Initially, Gary Custer got a very small grant. I think it was less than $3,000 from the Mott Foundation. And Bill White was kind of fascinated by Gary. Gary had this long beard and he rode a bike. He didn't drive a car or anything. He'd go back and forth between his apartment and so on, and would crank out this little 8-page black and white thing once a month. So he got a little bit of seed money in like 78 or something like that from the Mott Foundation. And then he never got any more money again until 2014, I think it was. He finally decided he would apply again. And he applied. Supposedly Bill White said at the time, this is the best investment we ever made. We gave this guy $3,000 or whatever it was. And that kept him going, you know, for 40 years afterwards. And Bill White really liked Gary Custer. They finally gave him some money at the end of 2014. He found out that he got, I think it was like $30,000. And it was amazing. Like, he had never seen that kind of money. Sadly, he got sick at the end of December of 2014, and he died just having signed the paperwork to get this money. A number of us who had been writing for him, you know, nobody ever got paid or anything. I'd been writing a column for him since 2007 on the back page of it. We went down to the Mott Foundation and, you know, went up to the 12th floor and said, okay, so he got this money. There's a few of us that think we could keep it going. What do you think? Can we keep the money? And they said, yeah. So that was a change. 2015 was quite a change in East Village Magazine because we began to be able to pay our writers a little bit. Nobody's on salary at all. Nobody's ever been on a salary. We're paying stipends now. We expanded our coverage We've gone from 8 pages to 12, 16, 20 pages. And we started covering City Hall and the Flint Community School Board quite avidly. That's Harold Ford is our education beat reporter. He's excellent. I was retired from U of M Flint in the English department by then. And Gary used to have these little 3 or 4 paragraph stories. And I wanted it to be more expansive. We have started writing longer pieces. I guess in some ways we're a little bit more literary than Gary would have had the stomach for. Like Gary was about subject, verb, object. That was it. That's all he wanted, you know, who, where, when, what, why, how, and then that's the end. And I loved him. And I think his family thought when he died that that would probably be the end of East Village Magazine, but we kind of wanted to keep it going. We thought it was worth keeping going. And we kind of wanted to carry on Gary's legacy. I was fascinated by him. I have a bachelor's degree in journalism myself. But I had been a newspaper reporter in Southern California for 5 years when I was a kid. And I'd been involved with writing all my life. So I was fascinated by Gary, the fact that he was so devoted to what he considered to be top level journalism. You know, he never got rich on it. He barely had enough to live on. But it was just his passion. And he just didn't tolerate any BS. I've told this story many times that
he really liked politicians either.
No, he didn't. He didn't indeed. I've told this story that every month when I would take my column over, I would actually take it to him in person in that office. He knew that I liked Bushmills and he kept a bottle of Bushmills in the back for me. So when I'd go to take up my column and edit the proofs and everything with him, he'd pull out this bottle of Bushmills from the back and he'd get this little chipped mug that he had that he put my Bushmills in, and we would sit there and talk about Flint. It was just wonderful. You know, I'm not a Flint native. I sometimes don't feel the loyalty to Flint that some Flint natives do. He was a great storyteller, and we would open the door of that office on Second Street and you could smell Flint. You know, it's like you could just smell, you just feel the community that he was so devoted to.
Do you think Flint has a collective identity?
You know, that I've thought about that a lot, because one way that I would answer that is to say there are a lot of writers who have had their roots in Flint who just seem to be like obsessed with it and hooked on it. And it's like the experiences that people have are so intense with Flint. There's a feisty kind of blue collar ethos, but like, I hate to go with a cliche on that because I think it's far deeper than that. I don't think it's typical blue collar mentality. There's some kind of feistiness against the system, but also a craving for, like I put it in a recent story that I wrote, I said that it was something about this blue collar or working class yearning for a certain kind of grace, fight against the man through the years. There has been the opportunity to make a lot of money, and there's this always boom and bust cycle. The damn town has had so much bad luck through the years. I do think there is some kind of thing that happens to you in Flint. Like sometimes people don't like that they live there. They wish they could have gotten out. But then when they get out, they never stop thinking about it like you, and they never stop writing about it.
So the question I have is it in the water or is it in the blood?
Well, I don't know. I think that's a hard question to answer. I mean, obviously it's a joke now if you say it's
in
the water.
No, I'm not joking. I'm trying to find the answer to that.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's this sense of the world has shat upon this place over and over again. But on the other hand, there's been this hope of glory. And, you know, there's been this incredible involvement in being part of the nation's structure. And, you know, like they used to make Corvettes at Chevy in the Hole back in the day. And they used to make Buick Regals at Buick City in the day. And like all these beautiful cars were going. There's a sense of, yes, we have made this amazing, powerful, beautiful thing. We also fought against the man in the sit-down strike. You know, we were the ones that stood up and stood in the windows of Fisher Body and, you know, won these rights for the working class. So there's a sense of honor and pride, sort of a stubborn honor and pride that infiltrates the Flint consciousness.
When I was growing up, there wasn't such a thing as a Flintstone, except on cartoons with Fred and Wilma and Barney, and they lived in Bedrock.
Yeah.
And they drove a car that they had to pedal with their feet.
Right.
And they went to work every day at the quarry.
At the quarry, yeah.
And they pounded rocks all day.
Yeah.
The guy was happy when he got out of work. Yabba dabba do, down the road he goes.
Right.
And so the Flintstone cartoon show came and went. Then in 2000, were some young kids from Flint who played at Michigan State University. They represented several of the high schools in Flint. So it was a pretty, you know, there were four schools. I think three of them were from different high schools. And they'd all went grew up together. The media said these guys are the Flintstones, and they embraced that.
Yeah.
And they got tattoos on their arms.
Yeah.
Flint tattoos.
Right.
Flintstone tattoos. Tom Izzo said he comes to Flint because he likes the qualities that these kids bring to bear. So that's my question.
Yeah.
That's my question. They weren't just feisty.
You know, who represents that complicated Flint psychology or whatever it is Ben Hamper. If you've, I just did a profile of him this summer. You know, it's 30 years since Rivethead came out, and he comes back to Flint. And so, I mean, that book to me is just brilliant Flint literature. I mean, the way that
he's still collecting royalties.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And Flint, even though that factory culture, he was so much fun to interview. He's like, look, don't make any big generalizations about this. It's like, I'm one guy. I told my one story. But it's inevitable that when you read Rivethead, that you start thinking about larger issues about the Flint psychology and the Flint experience, because it's just the wild resistance of people in the shop. And Ben contends that they were still cranking out good cars, even though that wasn't the reputation at the time. And he said that these guys in the shop made a deal, kind of. They navigated shop life in the quarry, if you want to look at it that way, of pounding rocks to make it on their terms with wit, wiliness, persistence, and resistance. Those are qualities that I connect with. With Flint, even now, 30 years later, I mean, he's sitting up there in his house in Sutton's Bay, and he says it's the best life he's ever had. And he's in the last line of my profile, he said, this is a life of glorious apathy, right? And that's like Ben Hamper. He loves that. But he's like a prototypical Flint person in the way that he experienced growing up there. You know, he grew up in Civic Park, not far from Gordy Young and Dan Kildee, actually, in that neighborhood. I've been here, I was 30 years old, I'm now 72. And I've seen this town just get hammered time after time after time. And the word resilience begins to ring hollow about this city. Like, how much damn resilience can you ask of a community that has been hammered time after time by political corruption, by post-industrial decreases, environmental degradation? You know, the water crisis has took a chunk out of the heart of this city. Okay, everybody says, yeah, Flintoids are resilient. But it's like, man, people are hurting. You know, we shouldn't have to be as resilient as we supposedly are. And I think that's an overused comment about the city of Flint. It's almost like it makes other people feel better about what's happened to our town. It's like, well, those Flintoids, they are resilient people. They're going to get through it. It's like, you know, some people did not get through it, and they're not getting through it very well. The schools are a mess. The public schools in Flint are falling apart. There's a whole generation or two of kids that have been denied decent public education. It's not the fault of Flint people exactly. It's the fault of the way all of these systemic things have come together. Because again, I would say that the governance structure in Flint has been pretty shaky in the last few years.
Well, I was going to ask you that. Now you're a journalist. I understand you don't like to tread in the world of politics.
Yeah.
And the East Village Magazine has been apolitical. I don't think, although they've allowed politicians on their board.
Right.
They do not allow politicians on their board to start letting their politics influence the editorial content.
We don't take editorial positions.
That's correct. And your positions that you do take have nothing to do with politics for the most part, except for why politics isn't working.
Right.
Now, my question to you is more simple. Do you trust the government in Flint?
Do I trust the government? it's extremely frustrating. I am continually in a state of schizophrenia about this town, because on one hand, this is a beautiful town in some ways, and I have a really good life here. And I compare it to LA, where my husband and I couldn't have afforded to buy a garage. We couldn't live well in LA. We live in a beautiful home in the College Cultural neighborhood in this city. And every day, like I'm looking out my backyard, I see birds here. I walk through Pierce Park every day. I have many, many friends here, people who have accomplished things, who are trying to write about Flint, who are trying to do their part to be good citizens. There's a schizophrenia about, I look around, I go, this is not the Flint that you read about elsewhere. The cliche interpretation of Flint that we're these broken down people and a broken down city. You know, I would want to bring up here this young writer named Kelsey Ronan, who I've been talking a lot about. She's got a novel coming out March 15th that's called Chevy in the Hole from Henry Holt and Company. It's an amazing, gorgeous novel based in Flint and about Flint. And the city of Flint is a character, a powerful character in her book. And she talks about how she said, yeah, there are crumbling things and there are burned out houses and everything. But if you widen your lens out, you see a nice little neat house next door to the burned out house that's got flowers on the front porch. And there are people feeding their birds and returning their books to the library and continue to deliver good lives to the city and continue to try to do their part. I would say that the people of Flint, yes, indeed, are the greatest asset that we have, because we're people that have, for whatever reason, even we feel we're trapped here. The first column I ever wrote for East Village Magazine, the first line of it was, I think, I never thought I'd stay this long. And here I am all these years later. And I want to have a good life here. And I'm trying to have a good life here. And there are many people here who do have a good life here, who are wrestling around potholes and water crises, inept politicians, crime and all that kind of stuff, and are still managing to deliver. So I guess, you know, if you want to call that resilience, I don't know. I think it's stubbornness. Like, we found ourselves in a beleaguered city that we still want to have a good life in. So there is opportunity for that to happen here.
There's a culture in Flint of activism.
And they fought. Okay, so the water crisis activism does depict or capture that Flint quality that I think you've been getting at. And what's interesting about the Mark Edwards story is, a number of the activists eventually turned on Mark Edwards because they thought he was being too arrogant and that he wasn't paying attention to their views. And he was, so it's like he overstepped his bounds as a leader in that story. And I find that typical.
He overstepped his bounds to the extent that he didn't have much to do with Flint water other than a bunch of kids. Pretty right. much there are a lot of young kids that showed up with these things of water and said, can you test them?
And well, he started disdaining what he called citizen scientists. He started questioning the citizen scientists, and which is, I think, a fascinating part about it, that there was a period of time when everybody in Flint was a scientist. Everybody was testing their water and they were turning in their results to the state. And Mark Edwards somehow kind of turned against that movement, which was prototypical Flint, that, you know, we were going to be our own scientists. Thank you very much. And we were going to do our part. I have great admiration for those water activists. A lot of them were African-American women who were just out there telling the truth, and they were not going to be ignored. But Claire McClinton is one of my heroes in this town. She's a union activist. She's just an amazing person and just always telling the truth and getting in people's faces in the right way. Very strategic and smart too. Flint doesn't fall easily into categories. So you have to look at things more closely and with a lot of nuance to try to get it. And even then there would be things that elude you in understanding this place. Let me give you a quick example. Somebody just died of COVID here. It's a very interesting case to me. And his name was Tony Palladino. He's a white guy, lives over in Kersley Park. And he had worked for the Flint Journal back in the day back in the press room. He wasn't a reporter. So he was like a classic old school Flint kind of populist, if you want to use that word. And he never trusted government. Even before the water crisis, he was in a position where he didn't trust government. So then the water crisis came along and it brought out this immense outburst of activism from Tony Palladino. I interviewed him probably 10 times, quoted him in many stories. He was very quotable, very interesting guy. So then the pandemic comes along. His distrust of government, in my opinion, is part of what killed him, because his experience of government because of the water crisis had made him so there's nothing that he's going to trust about the government, right? He got COVID. Nobody wants to say that he wasn't vaccinated. So I can't say on your show, no, he wasn't vaccinated, but I'm pretty sure in my heart that he wasn't. And it killed him, in my view, in my interpretation of this. There's a pro and a con of this kind of activism that's painful to watch. Like, in what ways can we in Flint navigate our way through corrupt systems and inequitable systems and constant pounding by people who underestimate the needs of the people? There, to me, there's like a simmering anger that doesn't take much to re-trigger for Flint residents. So one wonders, why do we always have to fight this hard for the common good? Why does it always happen that in this town in particular, we've had to fight this hard for the common good? It's just unending. Some of what I feel about Flint is I feel exasperation and anger on behalf of my fellow citizens here that have had to, people who shouldn't even have to fight for what they have to fight for. Time after time after time, they get beat up by some kind of corporate interests or some kind of presumptuous political decision-making that is devastating to the city of this town. So I feel anger about what's happened to Flint over and over again. And that's one reason why it angers me that people are saying, well, they're resilient, they're going to get through it. Just stop making us have to be resilient. We shouldn't have to be that resilient time after time after time. You know, the analogy I think of is when I was in social work school, one of my professors said one time, you know, we have to support shelters for women that are getting abused, domestic violence shelters and everything. This person said, no, what we have to do is to stop the domestic abuse. To start with, we have to stop the domestic violence. We should be working so we don't even need the darn shelters. That's where our attention should lie. That's kind of how I feel about some of the ways that Flint has been beat up on through the decades. It's like, stop, work on what causes those things that make it so hard for Flint residents to get through their lives.
How has East Village Magazine changed because the media, especially local coverage, has dissipated with our one newspaper that we had?
Yeah. Well, East Village Magazine, over the last 5 or 6 years, we have expanded our reach as the Flint Journal has fallen away. And, you know, M Live has this little tiny storefront now on Saginaw Street. And it's sad to see that. You need to have people that are witnessing what's going on, that are not part of the political structure, the political superstructure. You need to have people in that chamber on the third floor of City Hall that are sitting there in the second row, taking a measure of what's happening and telling the rest of the people. It has to happen. And if that doesn't happen, politicians can slide into unaccountability. As we've been talking about, this is a community of activism. If the community doesn't know what's going on, how can they respond appropriately, right? So it's not our job to be the activist, but it's our job to be the witness. You know, in the Constitution, the only profession that's mentioned in the Constitution, other than the legislative, the three branches of government, is journalists in the First Amendment. We have a role. And without playing that role at the local level, sort of the foundation of everything else is neglected and is in danger of being, the people are in danger of being abused. And that's happened. It's happened in this town. So East Village Magazine has really tried hard to do what we call the democracy beat, where we've got people keeping an eye on, an informed eye on the city council and on the Flint School Board. We're not taking a position. We're just saying what happened. Our leads are, this is what happened. This is what actions taken or not taken. If you don't do that at a local level, no matter how good your activists are, they're going to be hamstrung. It's going to be hard for them to sort out what's the truth of a situation so they know how to respond or to galvanize their troops. You know what I'm saying? There is a ghostliness to Flint. Like, there's a lot of ghosts. Like Chevy in the Hole is a classic example for me now. They've prettied it up, and I hate that they've changed the name to Chevy Commons. I feel like the legacy of the place should reflect some of that rawness of that goes with the name Chevy in the Hole. There's a lot of ghosts here of all of these struggles that have occurred through the decades. And
are you referring to the urban landscape? Because if you look at places like AC Sparkplug or Fisher Body Coldwater Road or Turnstead Plan Buick City, which is, I believe,
Buick the largest, City is haunted.
It's the largest brownfield in the United States.
Yeah, I've been out there a few times. I'm fascinated by Buick City. You talk about ghostliness when you go in there. You know, there's still the concrete foundation some places. The old Delphi site is somewhat the same. You can still see flowering trees that'll be right out in the middle of Delphi, for instance, that were planted because it was a courtyard when the factory was still there. And they had done this landscaping, right? So now the factories are all gone, but out there is this little flowering cherry tree.
A city that just wipes out all of its history, all of the connectiveness that people have to places, does psychic damage to those who reside in the community. It retards the development and acceptance of the new that's come along. And I am absolutely fascinated by what's happened in downtown in the last 15 years. If you ask people about downtown, and there are websites with groups, you know, there's Facebook groups and so on. Some of the most popular ones for the Flint area have to do with memories.
Yeah,
I know. Memories of Cupies.
Right. Yeah.
The memories of the Vogue.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
And they have to do with places that no longer are, like the farmers market. My question to you is, in your mind, in your opinion, do you think that Flint has been reckless in the way that it's gone about tearing everything down? Or is that a necessary thing in order to make a better city?
I think it's been reckless. I don't want to be completely polarized because, you know, there was a time in the 80s where we were calling Bill White Dynamite Bill because he was tearing down everything. And I remember sitting in Churchill's, I think it was, when some of those buildings across the street were being taken apart. And, you know, there was this big wrecking ball and we were all sitting over there drinking while the wrecking ball was taking down those buildings. And we were cursing Bill White when we were drinking our drinks over there because some of those buildings were so fascinating. But so again, there has been a recklessness to it. And it's a kind of repudiation of the struggles that have been carried out through the decades when you tear all that evidence down. But one thing I wanted to say was I had a therapist.
Has it done psychic damage to Flint?
Yes, I think it has somewhat. Like, look at Central High School and Whittier. Those beautiful buildings there have just been allowed to rot from the bottom up, and they're still standing there. And so every time you drive by, you're reminded of the wreck that is the Flint Public Schools. And it's a huge property, and it looks awful. And that has been mishandled. That property has been mishandled in a way that I just think is tragic for our psyche. You can't not make it into a metaphor for some aspects of our city life here. But the part I wanted to make sure that I said that I was going to say that I had this therapist once that said, in the face of a loss, you think you kind of assess your situation, like what is lost, what's left, and what's possible. And Flint has spent a lot of time mourning what's been lost. If we start thinking about what's left in this city, one of the things is that because the air is cleaner and the Flint River is remarkably cleaner, there are advantages to the post-industrial era here. There's wildlife over at Pierce Park. Somebody just posted a photo yesterday, Pierce Park, 5 deer walking through the park. And so everybody's looking at it and celebrating. There's a fox family over there. There's wonderful birds. Sometimes what is left is an opportunity to live in a cleaner, more beautiful place that's healthier for our children. Now, again, the water crisis sort of blew that to smithereens. We're still grappling with, okay, we know what's lost. Now what's left and what's possible? You know, some of the kids now, like Kelsey Ronan, who's writing about Flint in her novel, they've never known anything else but a destroyed city. And that's what they know. So they're thinking about it in different ways. Like she said, if you're ingenious in Flint, this is a quote from her from my profile I did on her, look at all the empty lots, start thinking about gardening. And she was talking about one particular person in town, a couple, Aaron Caudill and Franklin Pleasant, who run the local grocer here. They have an urban farm. My young friend Kelsey, the novelist, is like, this is a different kind of city. This could be a different kind of city. What is possible with what's left here? And some of these young kids are not looking at it completely in the mournful, ghostly way that people like my generation do, because they've never known anything else except this pretty destroyed town. But there are some young folks here that are doing some quite cool things, and they're thinking about it as, of course, we're going to make it better, you know, because we live here.
Your neighborhood has withstood a lot of bad news in Flint. It's still standing.
Yeah.
And it appears to be still stable.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder what you think the effects on that neighborhood have been from all the things that have gone on here in the last while, which is deindustrialization, which have cost the economy of this area billions of dollars. And probably more recently and more alarmingly, the Flint water crisis.
I don't know what the latest numbers are, but our real estate market in this neighborhood has been quite unceasingly vigorous. In some ways, I'm a big fan of like the effects of architecture. Like, I think architecture has an effect on how we feel as we're going through our lives. This is going to sound hokey maybe, but I feel like these houses over here carry a legacy with them that has been an ongoing strength to the community. These are good houses. These were houses that were built by people who knew how to do things well. And so some of us are managing to, within the shelter of these, of this good enduring architecture, have managed to hang on. Like, we love these places over here. You know that this neighborhood, a lot of the houses over here, back in the day, you had to sign a thing. It was part of your deed that you wouldn't sell to African Americans. So I was going to say, some of the things that have happened over the years are improvement. This, as the town, as the city has changed, as people have moved out, as old white people have died off, et cetera, this neighborhood now is more diverse. Certainly, nobody's going to agree to anything like, I'm not going to sell to a Black person. I think that there has been a movement toward greater equity and diversity that's been facilitated partly by the changing demography of the town. And it's a good, healthy thing, and it's helped us survive over here.
Why are people wanting to live in East Village?
It's beautiful, too. If you live in a town like Flint, to be able to cultivate something that's beautiful that you can live in day to day to somehow balance off all the rest of the difficulties that we have, it's worth it to devote some of what you have to beauty and to sustaining beauty. And I feel a powerful sense of community that I think is a Flint thing. Like, Flint is a neighborhood town. There's a number of neighborhoods here where there's strong local level solidarity, may I say, to use a good old Flint word. You know, when we lived in LA, when I was spending months at a time in LA, I never felt connected to my neighbors. It was always, I was so used to my Flint neighborhood where you know everybody that lives next to you and you reach out the hand of communitarianism to your neighbors. It's just like in LA, it was cold to me. Like, I never found the heart of, I know it's there. I know people, you know, say that it's there somewhere, but I never found it. And when I would come back to Flint, as soon as I got to that Flint, the airport where you go to the Flint gate, and I would start seeing people that I know right away. And I'm like, oh, it's a relief to be back where there's this strong, humane kind of communitarian approach. So,
well, my question to you is, will Flint make it?
What do you mean by make it?
Is it going to be a ghost town? Does it have the tools to come back to be something? And if it does have the tools to be something, what's that something going to be?
Yeah, it's not going to be like, it's never going to be like it was. This is not going to be an industrial success story again. I think this town, like has been the case all through the decades. Well, I mean, this town has sort of been a bellwether of what happens in other places. You know, to the degree that Flint remakes itself, that's going to be an evidence to other places about what can happen. My worry is that because the politics of the town is so screwed up, I'm not so sure that the decisions that are being made are going to be wise and creative ones. And I feel like whatever progress happens in this town is going to have to happen at the small scale level with all these young kids that are trying to do things downtown. And of course, as always, with the support of places like the Mott Foundation, the Community Foundation of Greater Flint, the nonprofits are going to be where the money's coming from because it ain't coming from anywhere else. I think we're in the process of trying to figure out the answer to your question, Arthur. I mean, I think whatever it is, it's going to be a new kind of combination of nonprofit and very, very local ground level efforts. I might add that the Flint River is one of our assets. It's beautiful and it's becoming more beautiful. It's not going to save us, but it is an asset that is God-given, if you want to put it that way, that's been tremendously abused in the industrial arena and now is coming back. And I'm so touched by the restoration of the Flint River. That's a sign of hope. You know, they have eagles down there. You can take a kayak down there and see eagles now and things like that. So again, I'm talking a lot about environmental issues that I think are ongoing. This is part of what's left here that we need to treat with love and devotion and commitment. And there are people in this town that are doing that.
If somebody wants to get a copy of East Village Magazine, or they want to make a donation to their worthy cause, how do they do that?
Well, they could send it. We always take checks and there's to East Village Magazine. Our address is on our website. We're doing a lot on our website right now. So it's eastvillagemagazine.org. There's a PayPal link on the homepage that we would love to. We need money. We really need money right now to keep local, to keep our democracy beat going. So that's where I would start.
Jan, thank you for appearing on Radio Free Flint. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Flint River water tastes like turpentine. Well, Flint River water tastes like turpentine. Well, they lied about the water. Now people are sick and dying. Well, the water was brown, smelled like chlorine. Still, the city officials said the water was clean. People broke out in rashes, some were losing their hair. They complained to the mayor, but he just didn't care. He said, Flint River water, well, it's pure and fine. He said, don't you worry, people. I drink it all the time. Dr. Mona knew that the water was bad. She gathered all the research that she had. She released a study. That study said, all your little children have been poisoned with lead. Flint River water tastes like turpentine.